This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. This Tuesday, the White House declared the nation's meat supply chain to be critical infrastructure. Donald Trump's executive order to keep grocery stores stocked with meat follows the closure of processing hubs due to employee outbreaks. Meanwhile, here in North Carolina,
House of Rafer back to sell surplus chicken. The lines are long. Kim Diener's following this in First Alert traffic. Kim, good morning.
Good morning, Barbara. That chicken madness equals a chicken jam, and Chopper 11 is high above the scene of that.
All right, talk about chicken madness and the bulk of chicken that's causing jams on I-40 while the nation fights meat shortages. I want to welcome Leah Douglas to the program. She's a reporter for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Hello, Leah.
Hi, Frank. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. Let's talk with this about this executive order and the series of events that led up to the president's designation of meat processors as critical infrastructure.
Sure. So over the past month, we've seen really a crisis emerging at meatpacking plants all over the country. Today, we have nearly 100 meatpacking and processed food facilities that have outbreaks of COVID-19, and at least 20 meatpacking plants are closed temporarily or indefinitely as of today. And that situation is bringing a lot of our meat processing capacity offline across the country, which is really creating an issue for meat companies and very dangerous working conditions for the workers at those plants.
And of course, those conditions are part of the reason that they're closed. Workers are getting sick. They can't show up.
Absolutely. And the meat industry has been calling on the federal authorities to take action here. And we saw this past weekend, the chairman of Tyson Foods, one of the largest meat companies in the country, wrote a letter in the New York Times and several other newspapers calling on, you know, the federal government to assist the meat industry with this crisis. And a couple days later, we saw the signing of this executive order, which invokes the Defense Production Act to essentially require meat processors to stay open and remove some authority from local and state officials to close those plants in the interest of public health.
So this is interesting because workers are getting sick. That's causing a bottleneck in the supply chain. The industry, the corporation executives write to the president and say, hey, keep our businesses open. These are the places where people are getting sick. And the president says, yeah, we need to do that.
That's right. And we're seeing other federal agencies sort of stacking up behind this executive order. The Department of Agriculture has committed to implement the order. A lot of authority is granted to the Department of Agriculture within this order. And also we've seen OSHA and the Department of Labor also say that that they'll enforce it as well.
Now, there's quite a concentration in the meat processing industry. There just aren't a lot of meat processors. So the few that there are very big corporations, have a lot of control of the market. Does that play any part in the industry's susceptibility to an outbreak like COVID-19?
Absolutely. You could actually argue that the reason that we're seeing so much of this, these domino effects across the country of plants shutting down is in large part due to consolidation. In our economy today, we have just four companies that control 85% of our beef processing, three that control 63% of hog processing. And so that equates to just a handful of plants across the country where that processing is happening. And so bringing even one or two of those plants offline or running them at reduced capacity can have a huge impact on how much meat is actually moving through the supply chain.
Well, that consolidation and industrialization, I guess, brings us back to the chicken sales here in North Carolina. We spoke with poultry processor that's running some of those bulk chicken sales that were causing those traffic jams. Here's Dave Witter of the House of Rafer.
We wanted to keep our process going. We wanted our farmers to be able to continue to raise chickens. We wanted our employees to be able to work and handle the processing. And in order to keep that going, that meant that we were probably going to end up with some excess product, especially because of restaurants being closed. So that part of our business began to really become less and less. So we obviously, if we're going to keep the process going, we're going to obviously have some excess meat. And so that was another reason for doing it. And then the third thing was there just was a need. And I don't mean just because it wasn't in the grocery stores, but because people were losing their jobs. People were getting cut back on their hours. I mean, it was an economic problem for a lot of families out there. And we just thought that this might be the right thing to do to help them out by pricing the chicken at a very low price.
So that's Dave Witter, manager of corporate communications and sustainability at House of Rayford. It's a processing company that has two processing plants in Duplin County, North Carolina. They recently started hosting massive popular bulk chicken sales out of the backs of trucks across the South. Leah, you know, we've got this picture now, or at least the vague picture, and I'd like you to fill it in for us, of a huge assembly line when it comes to our food supply, that these chickens can't wait, that they're on a very short timeline. They have to get through this conveyor belt and into the supermarkets and restaurants, or it spoils and is lost. Tell us about this chain that we're looking at and how it got so big, but also, in a sense, so vulnerable.
Sure. So we've seen enormous consolidation throughout the meat industry in the past 30, 40 years. There used to be a much more distributed network of independent farmers and independent processors across the country. And over the past three decades, a series of mergers and acquisitions, and assisted by some federal policies, lack of antitrust enforcement, has resulted in an extremely consolidated sector, which, you know, as we discussed, is highly vulnerable to these types of disruptions. And additionally, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic has really shaken up the food supply, because a good shorthand is the typical food supply, about 50% of people's food dollars are spent, you know, inside the home at grocery stores for eating at home, and about 50% outside of the home at institutions, schools, hospitals, places like that, and restaurants, et cetera. So as we've seen, you know, stay-at-home orders really drop out the bottom of that outside of the home market, there's a massive shift to try to get as much food as possible into the grocery supply chain. And that's just a major overhaul from the status quo. And that's why we're seeing some discussion of shortages, why there might not be, you know, your favorite products on the shelf at the store every time you go, is because the whole food supply chain is trying to funnel all this food into the grocery store.
And of course, because it's a corporate enterprise now, food production and the commodification of food, the idea is to speed it up and get it going as fast as possible. So these animals are now being fed and grown and sent to processing at a much faster rate than humans were doing for most of their history, right? So it means they're really in a bind when it comes to this timeline that the corporate food chain has created for itself.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, we're seeing now the next sort of phase of how this massive, you know, shakeup is going to affect the food supply chain is what happens to all these animals who are supposed to be in the supply chain headed towards a processing facility that is now closed or is operating at a reduced capacity because so many workers are sick. That creates a backlog onto the farm where, you know, a farmer might have, you know, 10,000 hogs that were ready to go to slaughter. Now they're sitting on the farm and there's nowhere for them to go. And there are estimates that, you know, we could see as many as 700,000 hogs killed each week as on the farm instead of in the processing plant as farmers struggle to adjust to the reduction of processing capacity.
It's interesting because we've talked to a number of economists over the years on this program and elsewhere who said if you really wanted to help rural development, you would decentralize the food processing business and allow more local processors, which create a lot of jobs, a lot of tax revenue, a lot of industry, and when you get into a situation like that, make you much less vulnerable. So it's fascinating to hear you talk about the scope of consolidation and how it's left us vulnerable. But now with this, there are some differences, right, between poultry, beef, and pork processing, right? What are the potential bottlenecks and how are they different?
Sure. Well, there's some difference in how long each animal can be sustained on the farm before it would have to be euthanized on the farm. For instance, a chicken just has a much shorter life and is ready to go to be processed in a very narrow window. Beyond that window, it's you know, the animal is really not going to survive much longer, not really suitable for processing. So we've seen, you know, in one one place in Delaware, that an area that was sourcing to a specific plant that has been affected by COVID-19, 2 million chickens in that area had to be euthanized because they sort of hit that window and they couldn't be sustained. And now we're sort of seeing that happening in hogs a couple weeks later. There's a little bit of a longer window they can stay on the farm, but eventually, you know, the farmer, it's very expensive to feed these animals. Something has to be done. And so far, we haven't heard much about what will happen with cows, with cattle that are being backed up because of the processing capacity being lower. Cows have a little bit of a longer window in terms of how long they can stay on the farm. But if this pandemic continues and we continue to see processing capacity lower, we'll probably hear a similar story about cattle as well.
And they do obviously have an economic impact, these processing plants in the areas where they are located, in the few areas. And so we spoke with Duplin County Manager David Brinson about how processing facilities like the House of Rayford's fits into their local economic landscape.
We're very concerned about revenue stability here in county government, and we're concerned about our unemployment rate. We also have the largest segment of our economy is agriculture in Duplin County. We're the number one agricultural county in the state with millions and millions of animals here in the county. If these animals are not processed, then we would face the possibility of having to euthanize those animals. So we are going to make every effort to keep our economy, our agricultural economy, stable by keeping our processing facilities open, which will allow our farmers to get their animals to market.
That's Duplin County Manager Davis Brinson. I'm here with reporter Leah Douglas. Again, let's take a look at the supply chain and talk about the farmer's role in this. And because clearly it's an important, the plant itself plays an important part in a place like Duplin County. How do farmers make out in all of this? Talk about their profit margins.
Well, farming tends to be a business with a very narrow profit margin as it is. And, you know, again, to talk about, just sort of to zoom out to the typical operation of the food supply chain, you know, everything, when everything is running smoothly, the supply chain is fairly effective at taking food, taking animals from the farm, making it into food and selling it to consumers. But any disruption in that process puts a strain on everyone. And one of the effects of consolidation that we've seen is in the meat supply chain, the entity making the most profit is the meat company. So that's a Tyson Foods, Pilgrim's Pride, a company that is controlling everything from the processing of the animal all the way through the packaging and distribution. And as those companies have gotten more and more powerful, they have squeezed people like farmers who are seeing their wages considerably lower than they once were. And they're also squeezing at times distributors or retailers, and most of the profits are going to those biggest companies. So for the farmer, it's a very precarious time, and certainly there's loss, there's financial loss associated with having to euthanize animals, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that as that reaches more states.
Leah Douglas is with us. She's a reporter for Food and Environment Reporting Network. And to tell us more about the difficult decisions facing poultry farmers and processors, I want to welcome Margaret Ross to the program. She's a poultry extension agent based in Eastern North Carolina. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Would you briefly give us an overview of the timeline now for poultry farmers and processing? How long are these chickens, you know, sort of on the farm, and how quickly do they have to get to the processor?
Sure. There's a couple of different ways that the farmers are able to grow these birds and send them to the processor. The first is mainly for the grocery stores. We see farmers are housing these birds for about 7 weeks, and those end up being about 6.5 pound birds. Those are the ones that you typically see in grocery store packaging. The other is for your bigger restaurants, the dine-in restaurants, obviously not at this time, bulk orders like cafeterias, prisons, etc. Those birds are grown for about 9 weeks, and they are about 9 to 9.5 pounds typically.
What's the relationship between the farmer and the processor in all of this? Is a farmer a free agent in all this, can kind of look for the best price, the best deal for their product?
So how that works is the farmer has a contract with the company, and the companies own the processing plant. So by default, they're in agreement to process those farmers' birds for them. So they're able to kind of all work together within network, and they always have a source to have their birds processed, unless, of course, we're in a pandemic like we are now, where it could be a little unstable.
How much choice do they have when it comes to a contract? Can they search around and get a number of processors and look for the best deal? How does that work for a farmer?
How that works is if there is a farmer that is interested in becoming a contract grower and working with a company, then the company owns those birds. And so what they will do is they build a farm or whatnot. The birds come to them. The company still owns the birds. The farmer is in charge of caring for those birds, housing them, feeding them, making sure they are properly managed. And then they go to that company's processor. So it's all one, it's all tied together, if you will. But the farmer knows what they're getting into. They have a contract that they can read over beforehand. If they'd like someone else to read that beforehand, they can do that as well. Farming has been around for a long time, so they know what they're getting into as far as the risk that they assume and as far as the risk that the company will assume as well.
Now, if the processor owns the birds, they probably care about, sort of how they're cared for and everything else. So do they also have to make agreements about the way the birds are housed and what kind of feed to use, or how much discretion does the farmer have there?
Yes, absolutely. So it's all a working environment. And so can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. It's all a working environment. And so what we do is, or what the farmers do is, within that contract, it specifies how those birds are supposed to be raised. It gives the time amount of when they arrive at the farm until how long that they will be there, what conditions the house needs to be, making sure that they are properly aerated and ventilated so that the birds stay cool and warm depending upon the type of year. A season, and they make sure that they have clean, fresh water all times, that they have the specific amount of feed that they need for whatever stage of life that they are in. Obviously, some birds have one feed they would need, and then if you're in another stage of life, you would be another type of feed that you would need. So, yes, it's all laid out in their contract, and they do have service people that come around constantly checking on them, making sure that if the grower has questions about how to do something more efficiently, that they're able to work with those farmers to produce the birds to the way that the contract specifies. And I always tell people it's important that people understand that farmers are so good at what they do. And even people, it's really important that you know that farmers care about the animals too, and that they want them to be treated well, and they want them to be raised properly. And at the end of the day, it's about that as well as them being able to make a living going farming this way.
Well, Leah Douglas, let me ask you about that last part, a reporter for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. How much leverage does a farmer have in finding the best deal and signing that contract? And how well integrated are these companies? In other words, is it a franchise agreement? Can they sell them the feed? Can they sell them the housing? That is to say the processors or anywhere up the chain. How does that work?
So I've heard in the course of my reporting on this sector for several years that many farmers report that they do not have a lot of choice in finding a processor to contract with, and that in the contract negotiation process, there's not a lot of leeway for farmers to have much say in the context of their contract. You know, I was just reading a report today that half of all poultry farmers say they have just one or two potential buyers to contract with in their area. So even if at a national scale, we're looking at half a dozen companies that are operating at scale in the sector. And in a region, it might only be one or two. And so that presents a barrier, an obstacle for farmers who, might want to negotiate for higher wages, might want to negotiate for a different feed, recipe, something along those lines. There's not a lot of leeway there for farmers to have much control.
Do you know if they're integrated? In other words, do they sell them? Does the processor or the person you signed the contract with also sell you the feed? Does it work like McDonald's, a franchise kind of thing?
Yes. So these poultry companies are vertically integrated, which essentially describes a company that controls many different tiers of its own supply chain. So they do, as was described, they provide farmers with the chicks, with the feed. They are responsible for the trucking and transportation. They have the processing plants. Brands like Tyson or Pilgrim's that are consumer-facing brands. They do their own packaging and distribution to retail. So these are really companies that control a significant percentage of their supply chain.
And I'm going to have to break here, but when you say provide, the farmer has to buy that from them. They don't handle it.
It's part of the contract.
Part of the contract.
Yeah, so it's part of the contract. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to take a break here. I'm talking to Leah Douglas, a reporter for the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and thank Margaret Ross, a poultry extension agent serving Eastern North Carolina. Margaret, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
When we continue, more about the meat processing industry and COVID-19 and the way it has affected both the supply and the workers in that industry. We'll talk about it on The State of Things in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina ranks second in the nation in volume produced in both pork and poultry. Alongside sweet potatoes and college basketball, our state's economy relies on meat production. But the coronavirus is threatening the pork and poultry industries. Processing plants across the country are facing outbreaks. But following an executive order that deemed those facilities essential, they're staying open anyway. And for workers at a facility in Chatham County, that mandatory status was not welcome news.
I've heard from workers also that just stopped going to work, even at the risk of losing their job because of fear that there's so many more people infected than the company is owning up to or knows even about.
That's Ilana DeBester from El Vinculo Hispano. And labor unrest is growing as mandatory meat processing employees fall ill and risk transmission to their families and communities. Leah Douglas is with me, a reporter for Food and Environment Reporting Network. Leah, talk about why these processing facilities. We talked about the fact that the industry now, the consolidation, and we've seen the vulnerability to an outbreak. Let's talk about the workers inside that plant and how it's set up that makes them so vulnerable.
Sure. So if you had to sort of describe or imagine the perfect incubator for a COVID-19 outbreak, a meatpacking plant is not far off from what would sort of be the virus's own place that it would love to incubate and spread. We in meatpacking plants, even before this pandemic, workers, you know, the status quo is that workers work in very close proximity to each other, shoulder to shoulder is how it's often described. They're working very quickly. These plants are, they can be cold, they can be wet and windy. So there's a lot of opportunity for the spread of any type of germ or disease. So it's not a surprise that as of today, we have nearly 7,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in meat processing and food processing facilities across the country. And we have about 640 cases in the state of North Carolina as well.
Would you describe for us some of the labor concerns that you're hearing from workers and union leaders in the meat industry?
So we're hearing a lot of reports that companies have been slow to respond in terms of adequately protecting workers who are on the line. And that includes, you know, already before the pandemic, workers reported having, you know, inconsistent access to bathrooms, working for very low pay, having no sick time off. So that was already the conditions that many workers in many places were struggling with. And additionally, with the COVID-19 pandemic, workers are still reporting that, you know, in many cases, they do not have enough personal protective equipment. The equipment that they do have is inadequate. They're still gathering in cafeterias and on the processing line. There's not physical barriers between them and their coworkers. And I heard from actually two workers from a Case Farms facility in North Carolina this week. They said that they had only received face masks and shields within the last week, and they've been working for several weeks now under pandemic conditions. So it's definitely raised huge workplace safety concerns for workers and their unions.
Have any of the big processing companies stepped up and offered paid sick leave or raises to their employees?
Many have, and we're seeing some of those policies start to roll out. I would say that many workers in many places still report difficulty getting their paid time off. Even if they do become sick, they, in some cases, have had to struggle with their employers to actually get that pay. And other workers have said, you know, even with a small bonus, the work is still just too risky to risk their lives to show up and continue working on the line. But the companies have made an effort and are continuing to try to roll out better equipment and better workplace protections.
Well, here's Ilana DeBester again from Vinculo Hispano talking about what she's hearing from workers in Chatham County.
We've heard from workers that are afraid to go back to work. They don't want to go back to work because they don't want to contract the disease and expose their families to it. They also are concerned from several workers that temp workers might be going to work even when they are sick. because they don't want to lose their jobs and don't know exactly what they will be entitled to. Even if they have these benefits, which is unclear, they're afraid of losing their jobs because the temp agency, as far as I know, has not come out to say that your job is waiting for you.
That's Ilana De Bester, who's executive director of El Vinculo Hispano, a Latinx community organization here in the Piedmont. She spoke to WNC about conversations that she's had with employees at Mount Air Farms Poultry Processing Plant in Chatham County. We invited Mount Air Farms to join this conversation and didn't get a response. Reporter Leah Douglas is with us from the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Leah, these plants were designated critical infrastructure. Can county or state officials do anything to, I mean, what are the rules? Who enforces them? And how potent are these enforcement possibilities?
That's a great question. And we're really seeing information still coming out about how this executive order will actually be enforced. There's some indication that the order does remove some authority from local and county officials to forcibly close a plant because of the conditions, because of the size of the outbreak in the plant. And there's also been some report from the Department of Labor saying that the Department of Labor may represent companies against possible employee lawsuits that may stem from employees of these plants believing that they're being willfully exposed to dangerous workplace. So there's been some movement around how to reduce the liability of these companies, essentially while continuing to run the lines under these conditions. At the same time, there's still a lot to understand about the actual enforcement teeth. And as I said earlier, the Department of Agriculture was allocated a lot of authority under the executive order to do that enforcement, and it hasn't been necessarily announced in detail yet what that will look like. So we'll have to keep following in the next few days.
Well, we spoke with the county health department in another region that's facing outbreaks at a meat processing facility. Let's hear what Wilkes County Health Director had to say.
You know, the end goal, of course, for our local officials and the health department and Tyson is to stay open and maintain operations at the highest level of capacity that they have and that they can. And so that is what our job is, and how we see ourselves helping them is making sure that they have those safety measures in place to allow them to continue those operations.
That's Wilkes County Health Director Rachel Willer talking about outbreaks at a meat processing facility in Wilkesboro. I'm here with Leah Douglas from the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and I want to welcome Mike Sprayberry to the program. Mike is North Carolina's Director of Emergency Management, also heads the Office of Recovery and Resiliency, and is coordinating the state's interventions at meat processing facilities that are facing outbreaks. Mike, welcome to State of Things.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank.
It's good to have you, and I wonder if you can tell us how the state intervenes when cases start cropping up in a meat processing facility.
Right, so we work closely with the companies, and we have deployed strike teams consisting of members from DHHS, North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, National Guard, local health departments, and we work closely with the companies so that we can perform mitigation measures that include implementation of strong infection prevention strategies, performing testing for case identification, and executing thorough contact tracing. So that's kind of what we do, and we track all these different meat processing plants throughout the state.
Now, we understand that there's obviously regulation and there's scrutiny when it comes to, you know, how processors and rules that are enforced about meat processing. But what happens in a case like this when a processor is following the rules and the assembly line has workers 1 foot apart, and we know that 6 feet is the appropriate distance? They're not breaking a rule yet, apart from the social distancing guidelines that are keeping us safe. What do you do then?
Well, I think that, you know, the safety of the employee is a primary concern. We know, we've heard it on the show just a few minutes ago, that we have these big meat processing plants that have been consolidated, and and they're focusing on economies of scale, increased efficiencies, and greater speed. And that greater speed is by having folks working closer together on the line. And I think what our job is to make good recommendations on how we can space people out on the production line to ensure that they're meeting those social distancing guidelines, as well as working with the plants to have them perform cleansing as necessary, and getting them, making sure that we're making it a priority that the workforce gets personal protective equipment to mitigate the spread of COVID-19.
Well, let's see how that works. Can you and have you gone into a plant where they're, say, a foot apart and say, nope, you can't operate this plant unless those workers are at least 6 feet apart, or we're going to shut you down? Can you do that? Have you done that?
So, to be clear, you know, emergency management is not a regulatory body, nor is the department, and the Department of Health and Human Services do not regulate these meat processing plants. The Department of Agriculture and the Department of Labor would be the regulatory authorities over those meat processing plants. And I can tell you that right now, all plants, meat processing plants in the state of North Carolina are open.
Well, but again, my question is there any authority in the state that could say this is an unhealthy situation based on what we know about the spread of this disease? People are taking this back to their communities. You need to spread out. Is there anybody in the state who can say that to a company now?
You know, like I said, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Labor have regulatory authority over these meat processing plants. I'm not familiar with what authorities those are, so that's a question that I would ask them.
Well, we put a similar question to Wilkes County Health Director about their work with local processing plants and hypothetical steps that they might have to take to intervene if there's an outbreak. Let's hear what Rachel Willard had to say.
Well, we really rely on the information that Tyson is telling us. Right now, we feel like the measures that they've taken and the virtual tours that we've done with them, kind of, we've been able to see and feel comfortable with those measures. So that's our next step. And then after that, we would have to work closely with the state to determine if it truly does become a public health hazard, how we would go about implementing those general statute authorities that we have. However, we know that general statute is used very rarely, and usually only when death is an issue. And we're not at that level by any means.
Rachel Willard is describing inspections at a hypothetical intervention at a meat processing plant. She's the health director for Wilkes County. Right now, I'm talking with North Carolina's Director for Emergency Management, Mike Sprayberry. Mike, county health departments have to rely on these companies for self-reporting conditions and safety measures. Are you worried that these facilities might be slipping under the radar?
You know, I don't think so. I think that we've been working very closely with the industry. They have been self-reporting. We're working with them to go and expanding access to testing for the different processing plants. We're working with them to provide mitigation measures to help take care of their workforce. So far, I think that it's been we've been working together well.
What can the state strike teams do to limit community transmission in areas surrounding these so they don't become hotspots?
That's a great question, you know, because obviously a lot of the people that come to work in the meat processing plants are coming from, you know, not just around the plant, but from other counties and maybe even other states. And so it's important, again, that we execute, very good testing for case ID, and then also execute thorough contact tracing. So I think that's what we're doing with all of the plants that have had outbreaks, which is two or more people coming up COVID-19 positive.
Leah Douglas at the Food and Environment Reporting Network. What is the enforcement around the country? Do you know? And again, getting back to this question of now, if you're abiding by all the rules pre-COVID, but now social distancing is clearly a public health requirement, are there any states that are making those kind of, are insisting on that kind of thing, or is that not happening anywhere?
It's been very, very varied around the country in terms of really even down to the county and town level. It's hard to generalize because some plants have made the decision themselves to take production offline and deep clean the facility even before there's one reported case. We've seen that in a few different places, whereas other plants continue to stay open and have not complied with social distancing guidelines, even after our tens, dozens, or hundreds of cases. And so it really depends on where you are. And another piece about the enforcement mechanism is, you know, as I was saying earlier, the Department of Labor issued a guidance saying they may take on cases of meat companies against employee suits if the companies have made a good faith attempt to comply with CDC social distancing guidelines and employee safety guidelines. Well, what's a good faith attempt has not been defined clearly. So there's still a lot of question marks around what authority is going to be activated at the federal, state, or local level to try to bring these plants into compliance.
Leah Douglas, a reporter for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Leah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Sprayberry is Director of Emergency Management for the state of North Carolina. Mike, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thank you, sir. Take care.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.